This is a case that may never have seen a courtroom if it hadn't been for one scared but convicted eyewitness. He had seen something he was sure was wrong. If he had seen a robbery or witnessed a violent shooting, he would have called 911. But what could he do when the death he had witnessed late one Tuesday night was also witnessed by a handful of police officers and no one else? And then some of those said police officers filled out reports that they would later be accused of lying about, or at least exaggerating what happened. There were no shaky cell phone videos of the incident, but there was one man and his son who saw what happened, and there were cameras inside the police cars. In 2014, when many in the nation were focused on reports of the death of 18-year-old Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, another police officer involved shooting death went almost completely unnoticed, at least initially. At the time, few news reports mentioned the name of Laquan McDonald, a Chicago teenager who was shot by police as he wielded a knife. Minutes before, he had slashed the tire of a police car and reportedly burglarized a truck. Official police reports stated that an officer shot him as he attempted to attack the officer. But a tip from an eyewitness a few days later suggested that there was maybe more to the story and prompted an external police review board to probe deeper. The autopsy revealed that Laquan McDonald was riddled with 16 bullets, hardly the type of injuries one would expect for someone to inflict while defending himself against a switchblade 10 to 15 feet away. The questions began to circulate. What really happened that night? Why was Laquan McDonald shot so many times? And had police really been trying to cover it up? Yet despite external pressure that came from activists, advocates, and the state attorney general, Chicago police didn't release the video of the shooting. Then came a taxpayer-funded bombshell. The city of Chicago offered McDonald's family a $5 million settlement. Suddenly, the public pressure to release the video intensified. When a judge finally ordered the video to be released, the district attorney's office had already announced its investigation into the shooting. In the video, Laquan McDonald is walking down the dark street. In the beginning, he swings the hand with the knife in it alongside him, but doesn't hold it up. As Officer Jason Van Dyke gets out of his police SUV, McDonald moves further away, towards a chain-link fence on the other side of the road. The video didn't show McDonald lunging at Officer Van Dyke. It showed him walking away. His body collapses to the ground seconds after the first shot, but the gunfire continues. Five police cars were on the scene.
Not a single shot was necessary or justified.
I shot him.
There were a lot of questions that needed to be answered in a courtroom. Mainly, did Officer Jason Van Dyke murder Laquan McDonald? Was he doing his job to protect the neighborhood? And how do race relations with Van Dyke as a white officer and McDonald as a black teen play into the whole case? This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 121. The night of October 20th, 2014, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and Freddie Gray were alive and unknown names to most of the world. Ferguson, Missouri was still feeling the effects of the recent shooting death of Michael Brown. Laquan McDonald, however, had just hours left to live. But Laquan McDonald had already lived a hard life. Prior to Officer Jason Van Dyke's trial, McDonald's juvenile records were released to the media. They reveal a short life plagued by abuse, neglect, poverty, and drugs. At 17 years old, McDonald had been a ward of the state of Illinois since he was just 3 years old, an order that came after his mother left him and his one-year-old sister unsupervised and she was burned. He spent his early life in and out of foster care and relatives' homes, eventually landing in his uncle's home. By the time he was 13, He had been hospitalized for psychiatric reasons 3 times. He was also 13 when he was arrested for cocaine possession the first time. Between April 2011 and July 2014, he was arrested 26 times, although never charged as an adult. The charges all related to drugs, including possession of heroin, cocaine, and marijuana. When he was 15 years old, he spent time in a juvenile detention center. Testimony from guards there would later come into trial, courtesy of Jason Van Dyke's defense. Joseph Plod, a guard at the detention center, said McDonald wouldn't listen when the guards tried to help him. Instead, he fought back with all he had.
Well, my partner kept telling him to calm down, relax, calm down, take it easy, Laquan. And Laquan just basically turned around at him like, fuck you. You, who are you? Don't tell me what to do. And my partner was like, calm down, Laquan. All we're going to do is move you into another cell. That's all we're going to do. Fuck you. I don't want, you know, don't touch me. Don't put your hands on me. So after my partner kept trying to tell him, like, calm down, dude, just calm down. All we want to do is move you. My partner went to grab his hand just to guide him. And Laquan got, like, agitated and put his arm back. So my partner hit him in the stomach, but it really didn't affect him. So when I saw that, I jumped up from my desk and I ran down. And I helped my partner grab him so we can get him to the ground. So we can get some control of him, because at this point he was resisting. He didn't want anything to do with us. He balled up. We finally got him to the ground. He was still yelling and screaming, wouldn't give up his hands, kicking. So finally, after like a 3 to 5 minute, it seemed like a long time, but like 3 to 5 minutes, we were finally able to at least cuff him. He continued to yell and scream. Then all of a sudden, he just got real quiet.
Another guard, Tyler Sage, described another fight where after he and another officer thought they had gotten McDonald to calm down, he continued to fight.
So I removed the first handcuff. Upon removing the second handcuff, he pushed up off his bed and said, I'm going to fuck y'all up.
In October 2014, McDonald was again living with relatives. His last day alive started out with a 911 call. Early in the morning on October 20th, about 2 a.m., a neighbor called 911. Yvette Patterson was returning home from a party after midnight. She found Laquan McDonald sitting on her porch. He lived in the unit above hers. Although she knew his relatives, she hadn't met him and didn't know he had started living there also.
He walked. He didn't come close to the car, but he walked over and he was like, can I see your car? And I'm like, what do you want with my car? And he was like, I just want to use it. I'm going to bring it right back. So me and him just laughing and talking. We talk. So I'm like, no, you can't use my car. I said, I don't even let my son drive my car. So no, you can't use the car. So he said, okay. And he started laughing. You know, we just sit there talk. I asked him, who are you? And he was like, I live upstairs. And I said, no, you don't. I've never seen you before. And he said, yes, I do. So I end up calling the police. I called the police for the simple fact because I wanted to go in the house.
Patterson said she didn't feel threatened by him. She just simply wanted to make sure she got inside her house safely. It was late, and she had no way to know if he really did live where he said he did. The next time Patterson would see her young neighbor's face, it was on the news the next day, announcing that he had died. Whatever McDonald did that Tuesday, whether he went to school or hung out with friends, it didn't come up at trial. What did come up were the drugs that were in his system that night. McDonald had done PCP, a drug that causes hallucinations. The drug can also cause users to feel increased anxiety, impending doom. And according to a pharmacologist who would later testify in court, possibly even act violently. The day started out quite differently for Officer Jason Van Dyke. He woke up the morning of October 20th and got his 2 elementary school-aged daughters ready for school. He did a few chores around the house before going to work a 4-hour shift as an off-duty security guard at a Walmart. Van Dyke grew up in Darien, Illinois, a middle-class suburb about 20 minutes west of Chicago. He joined the Chicago Police Department when he was 23 years old. His attorney, Dan Herbert, is a former police officer himself. He said that police work is a calling for many officers, but he described Van Dyke as a simple family man who just wanted a steady paycheck.
I would say with Jason, it wasn't nearly as much of a calling as it was just an opportunity for a good paying job. And, you know, I don't think it was ever something that became it's more of a job as opposed to a career for somebody like Jason. And it's, you know, not saying that he was bad or ineffective as a police officer in any stretch. It's just, it's a reality. He was different than I'd say probably most of the police officers that come on.
In 2014, Van Dyke had been on the job for 13 years. After his security job that day, Van Dyke took a nap. Then he got ready for his shift, which started at 9 p.m. That night, Van Dyke was paired up with an officer he hadn't worked with before, Joseph Walsh. They headed to a convenience store to grab some coffee at the start of their shift. On Chicago's south side, in an area just off Interstate 55, filled with warehouses and fast food chains, a man spotted someone breaking into trucks in a deserted parking lot for a trucking center. It was a Tuesday night at 9:45 p.m., and the lot was closed. When the bystander confronted the burglar, he was threatened with a knife. The would-be attacker then left the lot, turning around a corner. The man called 911.
Today, a holding citizen, 4100 Kildare by the United Rental, a male we caught breaking into trucks and stealing radios. He's holding them. And walking towards Plansky from Keeler, eastbound on 40th Street, being armed with knife.
Dispatcher sent two veteran Chicago patrol officers to the scene. Officer Joseph McElligott and Officer Thomas Gaffney had been at work that night less than an hour when they went to meet with the 911 caller. He pointed them in the direction he saw the robber leaving. The officers finished taking his statement and headed in that direction. About 50 feet ahead, they saw someone matching the caller's description walking in the street. They didn't know him yet, but it was Laquan McDonald. McElligott was on foot. He shouted at McDonald to hold his hands up. He saw a knife in McDonald's hand. Gaffney told McElligott to stay calm and called on his radio for backup and for someone with a taser to come help them.
Actually, he told me, calm down, relax. I'll get a taser over here. And then he got on the radio and he asked for a taser to come respond to our job.
McElligott drew his gun, following McDonald on foot at a distance while his partner followed in the car. While they waited on another officer to come with a taser, Gaffney pulled the police vehicle, a Chevy Tahoe, ahead of them, trying to redirect McDonald. McDonald raised the knife.
He walked into the vehicle, got blocked, and he spun around and he swung the knife down and stabbed our tire.
And when Laquan McDonald stabbed your tire, what occurred at that time?
The air went completely out of it.
Air fizzed out of the tire as it deflated. Gaffney tried again to cut him off. This time, McDonald scraped the Tahoe's window with the knife. McDonald then started to run, and McElligott jogged after him as the officers waited for help. Another police SUV pulled onto the scene, its red and blue lights illuminating the dark street. Inside were two more Chicago police officers, Jason Van Dyke and Joseph Walsh. McDonald changed directions and weaved towards a Burger King parking lot about a block away. Walsh, the driver of the second police car, would later testify that he didn't want an armed man to enter the fast food chain late at night, so he pulled the police car diagonally into the parking lot entrance, blocking McDonald from going towards it. McDonald walked in the middle of the road now, heading towards a chain link fence. He was no longer running. At this point, McDonald was surrounded by patrol cars. A few blocks away, a third Chicago police car carrying two more officers, approached. Jason Van Dyke, in the passenger seat of the second patrol car, got out. Van Dyke and McDonald locked eyes. 6 seconds had passed from when Van Dyke had opened his car door.
His face had no expression. His eyes were just bugging out of his head. He had just these huge white eyes just staring right through me.
According to Van Dyke's testimony, he, like the other officer, told McDonald to drop the knife.
He waved the knife from his lower right side upwards across his body towards my left shoulder.
Van Dyke started shooting, and he didn't stop until his gun was empty. For over a year, the exact circumstances of what happened in those 6 seconds between Van Dyke getting out of the car and gunfire erupting was clouded in secrecy, at least to the public. The initial police report said that McDonald had lunged at Van Dyke as if he were about to attack. But then, a witness, pulled over amidst the chaos of police cars flashing lights, was Jose Torres and his son, Xavier Torres. They were headed to the emergency room that night because Xavier had bad flu-like symptoms. When Jose saw the police lights, he pulled over. They had a front row seat for the whole thing, and what they said they saw was different from the police reports.
And did you have eyes on Laquan McDonald for several seconds before you heard those gunshots?
Yes, I did.
And was your attention ever diverted from Laquan McDonald during that time period?
No.
Okay. And did you ever see him make any threatening movements before you heard the gunshots?
No, I didn't.
According to Torres, McDonald had his hands down at his sides. He watched Van Dyke pull his gun out, and McDonald fell to the ground. What he saw horrified him.
What did you see after he fell to the ground?
There was a pause, and he wasn't moving for a little bit, and then Laquan, he just made movements, and then more gunshots started coming in after that.
Okay, and could you describe that movement?
It seemed like if he was in pain.
Yeah. Were there more shots fired while he was on the ground or while he was upright?
On the ground.
And could you give some sense of how many more?
It was enough to upset me. I said, why the F are they still shooting him when he's on the ground?
There was another problem. Before the gunfire ended, there were 5 police cars on the scene. Even with some of the police vehicle dash cameras out of commission, the others were working. The police cameras caught the entire incident on video. And those videos, analyzed at length, showed Laquan McDonald walking away. They didn't show him lunging at an officer with a knife. The next day on the news, as Laquan McDonald's neighbor learned about the boy's death, Jose Torres was watching the news for what would be reported as well.
The following morning, the day after the incident, I turned on the news. I wanted to see if there was anything on the news about the shooting. And when I heard the police spokesperson say that he was lunging, that Laquan McDonald was lunging at the police, and when I found out that all he had was a knife, I told my wife at that moment, I'm like, they're lying. This is not what happened.
Torres couldn't sleep. He wondered exactly what he and his son had witnessed.
So what did you do next?
I discussed it with my wife, and she was kind of worried for me to step forward. I told her I had to say something because I can't. This is just like a burden on my shoulders, and then it's eating away at me. And for the next few days, I couldn't sleep. And I told my wife, I'm just going to step forward. I'm going to contact somebody about this.
He remembered seeing a group called the Independent Police Review Authority in the news before. It's a group run by citizens. He found the group's website, called the number on it, and made an appointment to give his statement. But the wheels of justice spun slowly. Torres gave the group his statement just weeks after the October 2014 shooting. 6 months later, in April 2015, the city of Chicago offered McDonald's family a $5 million settlement. The amount was enough to draw journalists' attention. What exactly was the payment for? And where was the video of the incident? The video still hadn't been released. In November 2015, more than a year after McDonald's death, the district attorney announced murder charges against Jason Van Dyke, the first Chicago police officer charged in nearly 50 years. But other officers would soon follow. The video was finally released 13 months after the incident. In it, McDonald is seen walking away, about 10 to 15 feet away from Van Dyke. He doesn't appear to be making any movements towards Van Dyke. Instead, when the officer fires, his body immediately falls to the ground. The gunfire continues. The release of the video sparked days of protests in Chicago. Video of protesters captured by the Chicago Tribune showed peaceful groups filling Chicago's downtown shopping district, shouting about reforms, carrying signs with photos of Laquan McDonald on them, and chanting about the 16 shots McDonald was hit with.
13 months! 16 shots! 13 months! 16 shots!
In the year that followed, Laquan McDonald's name became synonymous with Chicago justice system overhauls. Policy changes were announced. The department released dozens of other videos and reformed its policies for releasing dash camera videos so there wouldn't be any more year-long delays like what happened in this case. The third-party police oversight committee that Torres made his initial complaint to was renamed and given more authority. Then, in November 2016, more than 2 years after McDonald's death, a special prosecutor said a grand jury had been called to look into a possible cover-up by Chicago police officers. More than 6 months later, in June 2017, three police officers involved in the case were indicted on charges of conspiracy, alleging that they worked together to cover up the killing. Officer Joseph Walsh, who drove the car Van Dyke was in that night, former detective David March, who investigated the scene, and Officer Thomas Gaffney, who was one of the first responders on the scene, were charged with lying to protect Van Dyke from criminal prosecution. First one, now four, Chicago police officers were facing criminal charges. In September 2018, Officer Jason Van Dyke's trial was set to begin. There was nothing routine about this trial. The city's attention had focused on the players in the case for years. Despite a bid to move the trial out of Chicago, the judge decided to keep it there. Picking a jury took 3 days. Even the jurors selected told attorneys that they had seen media coverage of the case. Demonstrators gathered outside the courthouse. Dan Herbert, Van Dyke's attorney, said it was more complicated than simply finding a juror who hadn't already watched news coverage and formed their own opinion. The jurors also had to be willing to be fair, even if it meant consequences such as protests in their communities.
You know, it was impossible to get an unbiased jury in this case, and you know, our polling completely suggested that. So, you know, unless there is a judge that, you know, has the fortitude to change the venue for a trial, we are not going to have fair and judicious outcomes. Because the fact of the matter is, if jurors are coming in from a county in which there has been significant protests and outcry. There is not a juror out there that I know of that will be strong enough to make a decision without being influenced by their community outrage.
Cook County called a special prosecutor, Joseph McMahon, to try the case. In his opening statements, he said police could shoot someone when necessary. But the shooting of Laquan McDonald was not needed to protect any of the officers. He pointed out that when Van Dyke met McDonald on the street that night, he didn't know about McDonald's past or the drugs in his system.
He had absolutely no idea about the autopsy findings that wouldn't come out for weeks and months later that showed there was PCP in the system, in the body of Laquan McDonald. He didn't know a single fact about Laquan McDonald's tragic and troubled childhood. What he did know, what he did see, was a black boy walking down the street on Pulaski towards a chain link fence and having the audacity to ignore the police.
He said there was a chain link fence on one side of McDonald, multiple cop cars who had him surrounded, and not a pedestrian in sight. The defense described Laquan McDonald as going on a crime spree through the city, ignoring officers' commands, and rapidly approaching two businesses with civilians inside. Those parts of the story were just as important as the video that had been shown on the news, Dan Herbert told the jury.
They want you to look at the final chapter without reading the rest of the book. They want you to go in for the final 2 minutes of a two-hour movie without knowing the context. What we're going to do is we're going to show you the context because it's important in this case.
The video from the dash camera was played for the jury a numbing amount of times. An FBI video forensics expert analyzed it frame by frame to check for any twitch in McDonald's body that would have indicated an attack on Van Dyke. He didn't find any. The medical examiner diagrammed the entry and exit wounds from the 16 bullets on McDonald's body. She said each of the 16 wounds contributed to his death. Some of the most telling testimony, however, came from those who could give their unique perspectives of the night of October 20th, 2014. Officer Joseph McElligott, one of the first two officers to approach McDonald that night, drew his gun on McDonald during his encounter. He was on alert, but he testified that he did not feel his life was threatened.
Now, after your partner had called for a taser, what did you do with respect to Laquan McDonald?
I just kept my distance. I had my flashlight out and I had my gun out on him. Just watched his move.
Now, did Laquan McDonald say anything to you when you saw the knife in his hand?
No.
Did he threaten you with the knife at all?
He held it out. He didn't say anything verbally, no.
The question, officer, is did he threaten you with the knife?
No.
He said McDonald never said anything to him that night, despite police following him, shouting at him, and additional police officers joining the pursuit.
And what was Laquan McDonald doing as you walked behind him?
He was turning around. He would walk forward. He would walk backward. He would backpedal. He seemed really out of it. He was backpedaling. He just kept walking away from us.
He walked away from you. Is that correct?
Yes.
The prosecutor asked why he didn't fire his weapon.
We were trying to buy time to have a taser. He didn't make any direct movement at me, and I felt like my partner was protected for the most part inside the vehicle.
Did he keep walking away from you?
Yes.
Did you feel you had the situation under control?
It was kind of like organized chaos. I knew there were cars coming. We were hopeful that a car with a taser was coming, but we were just trying to be patient.
On cross, McElligott said McDonald wasn't listening to his commands.
You tell him to drop the knife, I assume, right?
Yes.
How many times did you tell him to drop that knife?
Probably 30.
And he never responded at all, did he?
No.
He just kept walking away from you, true?
True.
He said after his initial encounter with McDonald, he went to stop traffic from coming through as other officers arrived at the scene. He said he heard gunshots and saw McDonald lying on the ground. He described about 4 police cars around him at that point. Officer David Ivankovich was responding to the scene with a taser, as requested by the initial responding officers. But by the time he got there, it was too late.
How long after you received the call for assistance did you learn that shots had been fired?
Like how much time had surpassed?
Yes.
I believe we were reaching 59th and Pulaski when the transmission came out that shots were fired.
And so when you pulled up, that's when you observed the person you now know as Laquan McDonald on the ground. Is that correct?
Yes.
McDonald was shot at 9:57 p.m. Officer Ivankovich arrived with the taser at 9:58 p.m. Adam Murphy, an officer with the Cook County Sheriff's Department, said he was sitting at a stoplight when he saw numerous Chicago police cars pass by him with lights and sirens blaring. He turned around and followed them, thinking they may need assistance. When he got to the scene, there were about 4 or 5 police vehicles. He saw about 6 Chicago police officers standing outside of their cars, talking. Laquan McDonald was lying on the ground.
I approached the scene where everybody was standing and where the subject was lying on the ground.
Did you do anything?
Yes, I did.
What did you do?
That time I observed that the subject was gasping for air. I put on my rubber gloves and I attempted to give first aid. I just kind of bent over, looked at him, advised him that I hear the ambulance and that the help was on the way.
Did Laquan say anything to you?
He did not.
Did you hear any noises coming from the body of Laquan?
He was gasping for air and gurgling.
After you said, strike that, what did you say to Laquan when you bent over?
I told him that the ambulance was on the way and that I hear it in the distance.
And Laquan did not respond to that, correct?
No, he did not.
Did you continue to hear the gasping or the gurgling coming from the body of Laquan McDonald?
No, it stopped shortly after.
Mark Smith, a paramedic with the Chicago Fire Department, testified that McDonald had a pulse and his heart was still beating when he was loaded into the ambulance. His heartbeat gradually weakened as they made their way to the hospital. He said McDonald was unresponsive the entire time, although they continued to work on him. According to Scott Patterson, a ballistics expert with the FBI, McDonald fell to the ground 1.6 seconds after the first shot was fired. The last shot was fired 12.6 seconds later, meaning that all 16 shots were fired in 14.2 seconds. The jury was then shown a video of an FBI agent shooting 16 shots in 14 seconds.
And how would you describe that rate of fire?
It's a deliberate rate of fire. It's methodical. He was taking the time to aim each shot. It was deliberate, methodical are the best ways to describe that.
Lance Beckvar, a retired Chicago police sergeant who used to be in charge of squad car cameras, testified that there was no audio available on any of the dashboard cameras. He said the microphones had either had their batteries removed or were turned upside down, but he said there was no evidence that they had been tampered with. The prosecution also had FBI expert Yuray Patrick testify on when police should use force. In his analysis, Laquan McDonald was not acting aggressively that night, and police didn't need to act aggressively in response.
I think they were slowly hemming him in and restricting his movement. They were isolating him in an area where he had no pedestrians or innocent bystanders, and they had the taser coming on the scene. They could continue to do that until the taser got there. If he did become assaultive or if he turned and attacked a police officer, then they might have been justified in shooting him. If he tried to break through, they had other, cars that they could block his presence with. You could even bump him with a car and knock him down if he began to get really aggressive or agitated.
So there were less lethal means to take Laquan McDonald into custody, is that correct?
There were, but everything depends on what Mr. McDonald does. Mr. McDonald very well could have ended up doing something that would have justified shooting him. At this point in time, he had not.
Joseph Walsh, Van Dyke's partner, disagreed. His testimony wasn't available on video, as per his request. He testified that what you see in the video wasn't the angle that he saw that night. He said that contrary to the video, McDonald did raise the knife prior to Van Dyke firing. When asked if he felt threatened, he said he was a threat with a knife in his hand, moving. He demonstrated how McDonald swung the knife and said he turned his head towards the officers with a stare and, quote, a focus beyond us. He said that he and other officers wanted to stop McDonald from entering the Burger King or the Dunkin' Donuts that was nearby. Walsh also testified that he was startled by the gunfire. Quote, I believe I flinched and bent at the knees. I didn't realize it was happening, so it startled me. Walsh said that if McDonald had dropped the knife when they instructed him to, nothing bad would have happened, and that if he would have put his arms up to surrender, it possibly would have resolved more peacefully. He said he was confident that Officer Van Dyke took necessary action to save himself and other officers. When it was time for the defense's case, they called their own forensic pathologist, Dr. Shaku Tees. The state's medical examiner had testified that all 16 shots contributed to McDonald's death, but Dr. Tees said the fatal wound was the one to his chest. The defense also called former guards and probation officers to testify that McDonald had been aggressive with them in the past, but on each cross, they all said that Jason Van Dyke was not present for any of those incidents and didn't know about them. Chicago police officer Letitia Velez arrived on the scene just before the shooting. She didn't see it happen, but she did notice McDonald's appearance right beforehand.
Could you characterize anything about the way he was acting?
He looked deranged.
And when you say he looked deranged, what do you mean by he looked deranged?
The fact that we had lights, we had sirens, he was not looking in our direction. There was nothing that was actually phasing him, not even the visibility of officers in the area, the number of officers that were there. He was just like in a twilight.
She said she believed at the time that he had a gun, but she later found out he didn't. William Shield, a Chicago police sergeant, testified that in 2012, there was an alert that came through about a possible gun that could be hidden inside of a knife. But on cross-examination, he said he has no knowledge of any ever having been recovered in his 27 years in the department. Van Dyke's defense also focused on the drugs that were found in McDonald's body the night he died. James Thomas O'Donnell testified that McDonald had used PCP, which he said can cause hallucinations, delusions, and aggressiveness. He said McDonald had also been prescribed two psychiatric drugs, a mood stabilizer and an antipsychotic, and that neither of these were in his system. He said that if he hadn't taken those, the effects of PCP could have been even stronger. However, he conceded that McDonald was walking away from Van Dyke right before he was shot. Dr. Lawrence Miller, a police psychologist and law enforcement educator, told the jury that in his opinion, Van Dyke responded to what he perceived was a deadly threat and responded in a way based on his training to neutralize that threat. He said for most officers, when they shoot someone, it's a fairly profound event that causes them to lose sleep, second guess, and have heightened safety concerns. They don't necessarily enjoy taking a human life, he said. Near the end of the three-week trial, Jason Van Dyke took the stand in his own defense. He went over the moments leading up to the shooting, beat by beat.
And when he got 10 to 15 feet away from me, what did he do?
We never lost eye contact. Eyes were bugged now. His face was just expressionless. And he turned his torso towards me.
And what, if anything, did he do with his arm?
He waved the knife from his lower right side upwards across his body towards my left shoulder.
And when he did that, what did you do, officer?
I shot him.
But under cross-examination, the prosecutors questioned Van Dyke's claim that McDonald was preparing to attack him.
And you told that to Dr. Miller when Dr. Miller interviewed you, didn't you?
What did I tell him?
You told him that he brought the knife up over and across his chest and was pointing it at you?
I told Dr. Miller that he brought it up across his chest like this, yes.
Okay. Now, you've sat here for several days. Where do you see that on the video?
I don't see a video.
You've sat here for several days and watched several videos, haven't you?
Yes.
Have you ever seen Laquan McDonald do that on one of those videos?
The video doesn't show my perspective.
The prosecutor pointed out that he had also said initially that as McDonald was coming towards him, he stepped back.
Yeah, I thought it that night that I had moved backwards. But after seeing the video countless times, I know I didn't backpedal.
Then things got dicey between the prosecutor and Van Dyke.
So when you got out of that car that night, you could have called and said, hey, where's the person with the taser, right?
Hypothetically, you could.
Well, it's not a hypothetical question. You could have called and said, where's the car with the taser, right?
I'm sorry, what's your objection?
It is a hypothetical question. You could have called.
Overruled. Hypothetically, anybody on scene could have called.
No, the question is you. You could have called, correct?
It was a very chaotic moment.
The answer is a yes or no.
And I'm trying, it doesn't just stipulate a yes or no answer. It's a very complicated answer. There's a lot going on at that moment.
You didn't even have to get out of the car at that point, did you?
You could say I also didn't have to go to work that night.
Barry Broad, another police force expert, told the jury that at first he had doubts that the second volley of shots Van Dyke fired was justified. But after speaking with him, he now believes that each shot was justified. He said the video doesn't show Van Dyke's point of view, and he stood up to do a demonstration for the jury. He stood 13 feet away from Van Dyke's attorney, holding a fake knife. He then rushed at him and pretended to stab him. On cross-examination, the prosecutor pointed out that his reenactment wasn't entirely accurate. So now the jury had to decide, what really happened? Did Jason Van Dyke panic or see something that didn't really happen? Was there a flick of McDonald's wrist that wasn't captured on video? Or did Jason Van Dyke consciously decide to shoot a teenager who was retreating? As attorneys prepared to send the case to the jury, both invoked thoughts of how things could have gone differently. What if Jason Van Dyke had simply stayed in the car, waited for the police officers with the taser? Was it really the threat of the knife that made Jason Van Dyke shoot? Or did McDonald make him mad when he wouldn't listen to him or his fellow officers.
An officer can order you to stop. An officer can tell you to do something. An officer can even arrest you for certain situations. However, they do not have the right to use deadly force just because you will not bow to their authority.
But the defense argued, what could have happened if Van Dyke had waited longer before he shot?
I mean, I don't know what Laquan would have done. I don't know if he would have attacked Jason Van Dyke. None of us do. But it's irrelevant to our analysis here.
After 7 hours of deliberations, the jury came to its verdict. Officer Jason Van Dyke was guilty of second-degree murder, the lesser of the offenses. 3 months later, Van Dyke's sentencing went before the judge.
This is a tragedy for both sides. So this is not easy, and I don't expect it to be easy. My findings are an appropriate sentence would be 81 months in the Illinois Department of Corrections, 2 years mandatory supervised release.
Jason Van Dyke was sentenced to 81 months, which is just over 6.5 years. But the trials weren't over. A month after Van Dyke's guilty verdict, it was time for the rest of the police officers to have their day in court. Thomas Gaffney, Joseph Walsh, and David March were all charged with conspiracy, obstruction of justice, and official misconduct. Unlike Van Dyke, their trial did not have as widespread publicity or protesters waiting outside daily. The three officers charged with covering up the crime were tried together, and their fate would be decided by a judge, not a jury.
The laws and general orders require justification in order to use deadly force. Immediately after the shooting of Laquan McDonald, the issue of justification became important. Those who are sworn to tell the truth began to fashion a story, to shape a narrative, to provide false information, and create the lies that were designed to help Van Dyke avoid the consequences of his actions.
This trial covered the same incident, but a different part of the story. It focused on the police reports and the aftermath of the shooting. Special Prosecutor Patricia Brown Holmes told the judge that the officers were so focused on trying to help Van Dyke that they even shooed away potential witnesses at the scene. She said one of the defendants, David March, instructed another officer at the scene to list Van Dyke as a victim of aggravated assault by McDonald. This case is about violating the public trust, she said.
The evidence will show, Judge, that defendants Gaffney and Walsh, as well as Van Dyke, also completed and filed within minutes of each other tactical response reports. You'll hear the term TRR, and officer battery reports. You'll hear the term OBR. And those reports contain identical information that they knew was false. For instance, that McDonald had not fled, that McDonald attempted to stab or cut three officers, that the three officers were battered, that the three officers were an imminent threat of battery, that McDonald had attacked the officers with a weapon, and more significantly, that McDonald had used force likely to cause death or great bodily harm with a weapon, all to justify Van Dyke's shooting and killing of McDonald.
Each of the defendant's attorneys gave their own opening statements.
Your Honor, David March is an innocent man. Not just because he's presumed innocent, it's because he actually is innocent. And what counsel just told you in her opening statement will not be borne out by the evidence.
Bill Walsh viewed the events that occurred on Pulaski that evening as a police officer who was trained to know violence, who was trained to see crime where maybe others don't see it. And he reported to the best of his ability the events that he saw and that he perceived as a patrolman. Judge, he did his level best. And by the morning after this incident, his involvement in this case was completely over.
The evidence will show, Judge, that that theory is complete and utter nonsense. What the state doesn't have, and what they didn't tell you, Judge, is they don't have a lick of evidence that there was any type of conspiracy here. They don't have a shred of evidence that Tom Gadsby agreed to obstruct what really happened to Laquan McDonald during the course of the shooting. In fact, Judge, the evidence is going to show just the opposite. Tom Gaffney was not a witness to the shooting. He didn't see what happened during the shooting. He never said he saw what happened during the shooting. How the heck could he ever be part of an agreement to conceal the real facts of what happened during that shooting that he never saw?
Investigator Earl Briggs with the Medical Examiner's Office testified that on the night of the shooting, Detective David March told him that McDonald lunged at the officers with a knife. Chicago Police Sergeant Larry Snelling, a supervisor at the Chicago Police Academy, testified that the tactical response report should have only been filled out by Van Dyke, since he was the one who fired his gun. But it was filled out by Van Dyke, Walsh, and Gaffney, stating that they had all been battered by McDonald. On cross, Gaffney's attorney pointed out that Gaffney had listed the address on his report as the address where McDonald had cut his tire, not the address where the shooting occurred. But perhaps most crucial to the cover-up trial was the testimony of Officer Dora Fontaine, who pulled up to the scene of the incident just as Van Dyke got out of the car. Fontaine said she told Detective March that McDonald may have been swinging the knife at his side, but that was it. She never told him that she saw McDonald walk towards, lunge at, or attack Van Dyke. But one night, months later, a co-worker texted her a link to a report about the shooting. The report said she claimed that McDonald was attacking Van Dyke.
I started cursing and said, "What the fuck?" I was upset because I had not said that.
Officer Fontaine called her attorney, but she never called her supervisor or filed a report correcting the false information. She said that after she spoke out, other officers called her a rat, a snitch, and a traitor. She said some of them wouldn't even back her up on calls, saying she didn't deserve to be helped. To wrap up their case, prosecutors presented emails showing that the officer's superiors even wanted to protect Van Dyke. One email was from one sergeant to a lieutenant, neither of whom was charged in the case, however, signed off on the reports. Quote, "We should be applauding him, not second-guessing him. Would a reasonable officer placed in the same situation take the same actions? The answer is absolutely." But one piece of evidence that showed that there had not been a complete cover-up was that the video of the shooting had been preserved for more than a year, Detective March's attorney argued.
He made sure it never got deleted. He made sure that if anybody wanted to see it someday, whether it's a police superintendent, a mayor at City Hall, or even the public, Dave March kept it preserved.
After 5 days of testimony, Judge Domenica Stevenson was ready with her verdict. It took nearly an hour for her to address each issue. The state's indictment accused the officers of obstruction of justice, misconduct, and conspiracy. But Judge Stevenson said there was not enough proof that the officers purposefully hid evidence.
The question is whether these officers intentionally or recklessly completed these swarms with false information. The state argues that the information in the reports is false because it is in conflict with the video and because they were filled out with almost identical information. Two people with two different vantage points can witness the same event but describe it differently. This does not necessarily mean that one of them is lying. Rather, it could be an indication that they are describing what they saw from their vantage point with their own perceptions. In contrast, people who view the same incident can also describe the event similarly. As before, this does not mean that if they do this, they are lying.
All three officers who had since been fired from the police department were acquitted of the charges. As the United States continues to process police custody deaths and gears up for other police officers charged with crimes, there's understandable discord. Dan Herbert, Van Dyke's attorney, said he worried police will become in danger, especially in high crime neighborhoods like the part of the city Van Dyke was working that night.
Well, I think a classic example just occurred a couple days ago in Chicago, and that was an individual actually shot a Chicago police officer, and there was multiple police officers around, and not a single person fired their weapon at this individual. So does it have, did that case and do these other cases have a chilling effect? There is no question that it does. And especially in cases where, you know, like with Van Dyke, you know, his training and the policy was that an individual with a knife within 30 feet was a potential deadly threat. Here he had 10 feet away, and then Illinois state law clearly allowed him to use force for a number of reasons, also, not the least of which, taking out the fear of his life. You know, that you can, we can argue, but I would say a policy, a police department clearly said that that individual was in a position where he can cause great bodily harm to Van Dyke, but also the fleeing felon. He was able to shoot this individual, even if he didn't think he was causing a threat to him or his partners, but simply because he was fleeing, a lawful arrest after committing forcible felonies, and he was using a deadly weapon as a means to his escape. So the law clearly allows for that. The training allows for the shooting. And when police officers get charged and get convicted for things that the legislators have told them they can do and their supervisors have trained them to do, yeah, it leaves them very puzzled, scared, and with an immense feeling of helplessness.
Moments before the judge had issued his sentence, Jason Van Dyke stood before him. His police officer's uniform, badge, and gun had been turned in years before. He was no longer wearing the gray suit and silk tie that he had worn during his trial. No longer clean-shaven, he had grown a shaggy, sandy blonde beard and mustache. He wore prison-issued orange scrubs. Van Dyke spoke to the court, quote, "I have prayed daily for the soul of Laquan McDonald, and it was due to my actions that the McDonald family has suffered and felt pain due to the loss of a family member. The taking of a human life is not to be taken lightly. As a God-fearing man and father, I will have to live with this the rest of my life, taking this to my grave." To quote an author whose name I can't remember, "All life has meaning under all conditions. This has not been lost on me as I think about this daily." And that's all for this episode. As always, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this case. Let me know by joining the discussion on Instagram at Court Junkie, tweeting me at Court Junkie Pod, or emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. This episode was researched and written by Sarah Yonker. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.